You are about to listen to an episode of The Cypher before it was The Cypher. For our first 75 episodes, we were known as Outside the Lines with Rap Genius, and we had a slightly different format. In all honesty, our production value and sound quality today is much improved from these early episodes. That said, the content is so great that these shows are a valuable part of our archive. If you want more information about our transition, make sure to check out episode 76 with Ritz, which was our first one under the new name. To keep up to date on everything involving The Cypher, visit us online at thecyphershow.com or find us on iTunes. And now, without further ado, here's The Cypher before The Cypher.
Rap Genius,
not only were they politically admirable for the most part, but the music they made would really take your head off.
Welcome to Outside the Lines with Rap Genius. I'm your host, Same Old Sean. This episode, we have an epic conversation with Bill Adler. Bill is best known for his term as head of publicity at Rush Artist Management and Def Jam Records from their start in 1984 through 1990. During that period, he worked with artists like Curtis Blow, Run-DMC, Houdini, LL Cool J, Slick Rick, The Beastie Boys, Big Daddy Kane, and tons more, a lot of whom he talks about during the course of our interview. He's also written several books, including the authorized biography of Run-DMC, Tougher Than Leather, and Def Jam Recordings, the first 25 years of the last great record label. In addition to his time at Def Jam, Bill was a champion of hip-hop photography, running the iJammy Arts Gallery. He was also the producer and writer of And You Don't Stop, 30 Years of Hip-Hop, a multi-part documentary on VH1. Another project Adler's put together that's close to my heart is the Adler Archives, his personal files on just about every important musical figure of pretty much the past half century. As always on Outside the Lines, we bring you a special kind of audio footnotes throughout the show. Every time you hear this sound,
Rap Genius,
go to rapgenius.com and search for OTL43. There you'll find extra audio, video, and information to bring you further outside the lines. Now, here's our conversation with Bill Adler. Outside the Lines with Same Old Sean, here with Bill Adler, a.k.a. Il Badler. Legendary publicist, writer, documentarian, cultural worker, all kinds of things. For folks who might know your work but not your name necessarily, can you fill us in a little bit about who you are?
Probably I'm best known for having worked as the director of publicity at Def Jam Recordings between 1984 and 1990.
Mm-hmm. So that was the very, very, very... Well, you actually predated Def Jam as a label, right?
I did, just a little bit. You know, Rick Rubin put out the very first Def Jam record with Tila Rock early in 1984.
People forget about that record, man. It's really, you know, it was the first one with the logo, but it's not
absolutely
thought of as, you know...
Well, I'm not going to forget. So there it is. And then, you know, he and Russell Simmons teamed up in the wake of the release of the Tila Rock and Jazzy J record. And it was around that time. So they might have met in the spring of 84, and I started working with Russell in, say, late June of 1984. And then the first kind of official Def Jam single started to be released in the fall of 1984. You know, LL Cool J puts out I Need a Beat, which was DJ 001, and it went on from there.
Wow. DJ 001. Do you have a copy of that anywhere? You must.
Of course.
Yeah. Definitely. And you've done a ton of other stuff, you know, both pre and post that.
I'm old. I had to have done something, you know.
So you started out in Michigan writing for...
I started out in Brooklyn, New York, where Rap Genius is located right now. I was born in Brooklyn.
Ah.
But we moved to Detroit before I was five. And, you know, I went to Detroit Public Schools and through the ninth grade, and then the suburbs. I went to Southfield High School, where a certain Alon Zachary would go, years later, a generation later. And then in fall of 1969, I went to Ann Arbor, the University of Michigan, and I was not an excellent student. Those were tumultuous times.
And, you say the fall of 1969 is an interesting time to be in college.
It's a great time to be in college, and it's a great time to be there in particular because it was such a vibrant place, and it was such a center of hippie culture. And, you know, I absorbed all of that. It was very, very formative to me. And, you know, among other things, you know, I mean, I really started to find myself there, and you know, I understood more clearly than I had before that probably whatever it was I did, I wanted music to be at the center of it. You know, I'd always been a music lover, but, you know, in Ann Arbor at that time, it was vibrant in a lot of ways. It was, you know, broadly it was vibrant politically, and it was also vibrant creatively and musically. It was a great little city for music, and so all of that was tremendously formative to me.
Amazing. And you started doing music writing there?
Yeah, there was a hippie newspaper that was published by the Rainbow People's Party. Actually, it was published by Rainbow Media, which was a mutation of the Rainbow People's Party, which had come out of the White Panther Party, which was formed in solidarity with the Black Panthers by John Sinclair, you know, X number of years earlier. He formed the White Panther Party in the 60s and the Rainbow People's Party in the early 70s, and then Rainbow Multimedia. And also, at that point, I'm trying to think, maybe 1971, he revives the Ann Arbor Sun. It had been the Detroit or the Forest Warren Sun, which was named for an intersection in the hippie community in Detroit. And then he revives it as the Ann Arbor Sun in 1971. And I start working there late 73, early 74, writing about music. And it's not like I had done any of it before, but the guy who was the editor at the time, a friend of mine, David Fenton, knew that I was working in a little record store, university record store, selling records, and I appeared to be pretty knowledgeable, and he needed somebody who could write. And he had a guy who'd been a local radio DJ who didn't meet his deadlines, and so he took a shot and he asked me if I would do it, and I said yeah, and I was able to meet my deadlines, and so I was in.
Nice.
Yeah.
And so did you work closely with Sinclair during that period, or was he
I worked pretty closely with him, although, you know, you didn't have to be up under him to feel his influence in Ann Arbor at that time. He's a really big personality, and I would, you know, advise your listeners and your readers to do some research on John Sinclair because, you know, I don't know that he gets the props that he needs. He was a very, very big figure at that time, and in that place, I guess he achieved some international notoriety. Late in 1971, he'd been imprisoned. He was just a big hippie leader. He was like the local, you know, for lack of a better way of saying it, he was the Abbie Hoffman of Ann Arbor and Detroit. And he got imprisoned in 68, 69 maybe for possession, not sale, but possession of two joints of marijuana. The state of Michigan conspired to put his ass in jail for 10 years. And there was a Free John Sinclair campaign that went on the whole time, and it kind of culminated in December 1971 when there was a Free John Sinclair rally at which Stevie Wonder and John Lennon and Yoko Ono performed, and it sprung him from jail. And then in 72, Lennon writes his album, or he, you know, composes his album sometime in New York City, and one of the songs was called John Sinclair. And, you know, so that's a very political period for Lennon, and you know, I'm guessing, I mean, you know, it's unfair to reduce John's, I haven't even described his work really, but, you know, I suppose he achieved his highest international visibility with the recording and the release of that song. But, you know, he'd been a poet, and then he became a political activist, and, you know, he's a tremendous music lover, and just a big personality. He kind of magnetized people. And bottom line, during that period, he was a revolutionary, and he believed that, you know, he was working to create an American revolution along with, you know, various colleagues and whatnot. So I probably You know, when I met him, 73, 74, I don't know that he necessarily saw himself on the barricades at that point. You know, I don't know if his revolutionary ardor had cooled necessarily, but, you know, he wasn't looking to plant any bombs or take on the U.S. military at that point. Mm-hmm. You know, he was concentrating more on culture. I mean, one of the things that he did during that period that was tremendously influential to me and enriched the entire community is that he was, you know, the brain behind, he was the genius behind the Ann Arbor Blues and Jazz Festivals, which he essentially produced between, I think, 72 and 75, and these were magnificent events. And that was all John.
Rap Genius.
Something he and John Lennon had in common in that sort of early 70s period was harassment by the feds.
Well, yeah, and you know, it's not, you know, the federal, it's a matter of record that, you know, the federal government, under Richard Nixon particularly, took the so-called threat of the counterculture very, very seriously, and they did what they could to subvert it, and they did it hand in glove with the FBI. And the FBI was a very backwards, regressive, repressive force in American society. I mean, you know, all of that stuff is still coming out, the extent to which that they worked diligently to subvert the civil rights movement starting in the 50s. And, yeah, they chased the hippies. And, you know, the story about Lennon is undoubtedly better known than the story about Sinclair. But, yeah, John Lennon, you know, so he meets, actually, you know, Lennon's troubles begin, or they're really amped up at the point that he meets John Sinclair because, you know, he helps spring Sinclair from...
They say, hey, man, this guy can write a song and get someone out of jail, you
know? No. Real, yeah, I'll tell you real particularly what it was. It was, so December 71, they have this concert, and 3 days later, John's out of jail. And by January of 1972, John Sinclair and John Lennon are conspiring. And the idea was this. 1972 was an election year. The idea was to get Richard Nixon out of power. Sinclair says, look, we're going to put together a series of concerts, and we'll go from city to city, and you, John Lennon, will headline, and we're going to, you know, pack, you know, we're going to put together a magnificent bill. And everywhere we go, young hippies are going to flock. And at every site, we're going to get them to register to vote.
Which is the first time 18-year-olds could vote.
Right. So we're going to register them to vote, and then we're going to organize it so that the tour culminates in San Diego at the Republican Convention in whatever it would have been, August of 1972. It'll be a grand rally. And we will vote Richard Nixon out of office. And before the end of January 1972, the Attorney General had got wind of these plans. And I think probably also before the end of January, certainly no later than February of 1972, John Lennon started to have very, very serious immigration problems. And the effect of it was what the government wanted the effect to be. Namely, you know, he pulled back from his political organizing and his agitating.
Yeah, and one of the things that is interesting that I think a lot of people don't put together is that that FBI harassment, you know, leads to and coincides with and, in my view, leads to his sort of lost weekend period and a temporary split with his wife and all kinds of stuff.
That's a little more speculative, yeah. Sean, in my idea. But, you know, it's as likely as anything else.
Yeah, sure. Certainly couldn't have helped.
Right.
Definitely.
Wait, tell me again. What do you call yourself? Super Sean? No, what kind of Sean?
Same old Sean.
Same old Sean.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, I'm going to, yeah. Why same old? That's too self-deprecating.
It should
be Super Sean.
Super Sean. Maybe I'll keep that. So you left Ann Arbor, and you were in Boston for a while.
Yeah.
And wrote for a paper, the real paper, which was, you know, split off from the Boston Phoenix.
Right.
So what was that like? At that
you know, point? I went to Boston, and it was I went there ignorant, but open-minded. you know, I had no relatives and no friends in New England. I might have had one pal out of my, you know, high school graduating class of 1,000, 1,100 kids. You know, maybe one kid went to Yale, and I visited him there. But mostly, New England was terra incognita to me. I didn't know anything about it. You know, it was a place where the you know, large parts of the Revolutionary War were fought 200 years earlier. That's what I knew. I did all right there. I personally did all right. You know, I got some work on the radio, and I wrote for the real paper, and then I got myself a job writing for the Boston Herald about music. And the Herald was a viable daily newspaper, the second newspaper in a two newspaper town, and it was all. It was fine for me personally, but I never warmed up to Boston as a place to be. It struck me very early on as a kind of a supremely odd place. I moved in February of 76, and on the 4th of July 1976, it happened to be the American Bicentennial. And you know, there'd been this kind of brewing racial tension for years and years in Boston. Most of it kind of centered on the efforts to desegregate Boston schools with busing. And on the 4th of July, 1976, there were celebrations, of course, throughout the city, but there were some black folks who put together a protest at Government Center downtown in Boston. And that protest, it was a nonviolent protest, but it was broken up violently by a bunch of white folks from South Boston. And on that day, at that moment, there was a photo shot, became a very famous photo, of a white man with an American flag on a staff in his hands beating a black man on the ground. The shot was made by a guy named Stanley Forman, who was shooting it for the Boston Herald, as a matter of fact, and won a Pulitzer Prize. But I saw that picture in the paper the next day, July 5th, and I thought to myself, where the fuck am I? What is this? And so, you know, long story short, I never really did warm up to Boston. Not enough black folks, not enough Jews for me.
Mm-hmm. Well, it definitely is a lot different than New York and...
It's different than any place, you know, that I'd ever been. I didn't know people who self-identified as Irish. You know, the white people in Detroit, if they were hillbillies, they'd come up from the South to work in the auto factories. You know, the idea that you've got this tremendous Irish pride or Italian working class pride, and you're going to set yourself up against, you know. Black folks in particular, that stuff is retarded to me. I'd never seen it.
Yeah. So when did you end up in New York? Or back in New York?
I moved on the 1st of July, 1980. I was back in New York.
Wow.
Yeah.
Nice. And so you were doing some freelance writing...
I spent 4 years, you know, trying to make some headway. I mean, truthfully, I'd tried to find a job before I came to the city, and I wasn't able to. You know, I was, you know, certainly smart enough to understand that I didn't want to go to New York without a job. I didn't want to have to come here and scuffle. It's hard and it's expensive in New York, even then, 1980. But in fact, I couldn't find a job ahead of time, and I really just had it with Boston. And so I moved, and I spent 4 years scuffling. And I did all right as a freelancer. You know, I wrote for People Magazine, The Village Voice, and Rolling Stone, and I wrote, you know, quite a bit for the Daily News. But I had not put together a living wage when I met Russell. I mean, I'll say this, you know, I certainly was paying attention to rap. I mean, I was still in Boston when the first Rap Records came out in 1979. And, you know, those were tremendously impactful. I mean, even if I hadn't been able to feel the music, I wouldn't have been able to ignore kind of the social impact of the music. The thing that always struck me about rap was that it was so popular so early on. And I always saw it a kind of in contrast to punk rock, because punk rock, at least in America, was a failed revolution. You know, the critics embraced it, and the American record buyer, the American music lover, the rock-oriented American music lover didn't even pretend to give a fuck about it, punk rock, right? I mean, you know, all these years later, you look back at the Ramones, let's say. Great, great band. Great band. They never sold 6 records in America. I don't think they had a single record go gold. I might be wrong. But that's, you know, so, okay, so that's what's going on. The best of those bands can't go gold. And here comes Rapper's Delight, a 15-minute long single. And not only is it multi-platinum, but it charts in a dozen countries. Curtis Blow comes out with Christmas Rappin' late in December.
Written by another newspaper writer.
Two of them, actually. Yeah, he comes out in December of 1980, and the thing is so magnetic that they're still playing it in Boston, which is not hospitable to black music. In fucking February of 1981, they're playing a Christmas record 3 months later. You know, you couldn't not pay attention to this stuff.
Yeah. That record in particular is so crazy to me because...
Who, Kurtz?
Yeah, because it's... And we'll get to your history with him in a second, but it's just such a bizarre record in that there's the sort of 12 Days of Christmas thing, you know, written by other people, and then his kind of live routine at the time stuck on at the end and sort of no acknowledgement that it's going from one to the other. It's sort of two separate records kind of smushed together.
Right. Well, you know, you can say... It was early days, and that, you know, the art form would develop. I mean, it was super, super early days for rap on record. The whole idea of it was so outlandish that none of the people who made the music, who'd been making the music for 10 years by the time Rapper's Delight comes along, it had never occurred to them. How do you take a party and put it on a record? You know, it takes a genius like, you know, Sylvia Robinson. She's an older woman. She's a rock era person. You know, she's smacked in the face with a live rapper one day. And because she'd been in the record business since she herself was a teenager in the early 50s, you know, she said, you know what? If there were a way to put this kind of thing on a record, we can go to the moon with it. But, you know, very, very early days, 1979, 1980, you know, all the early records were experiments. But as I said, there's something intrinsically about the art form that that appears to be internationally popular. It just took off.
Man. So Curtis Blow, you ended up writing a profile on him. And
right.
that put you in contact with his manager. But I was reading an interview with you, and there was kind of another part of that story that you were talking about where you were attempting to write a rap for him, and that was part of, you know, a part of bringing you into contact with him.
Yeah, you know, I interviewed Kurt in 1980 for the Daily News, and you know, I don't think I met Russ then, but I started to hear about him. You know, I met Kurt's songwriters. I met J.B. Moore and Robert Ford, who'd you know, written and produced Kurt's records. And then in early 83, I sold People magazine on the idea of doing a story about rap music, this burgeoning scene. And my idea to begin with was, you know, I would just do kind of a survey piece, you know, here's the scene in New York, and it's taking place in a variety of different places, and there's a variety of record labels, and there are, you know, there's more than a handful of stars, and, you know, blah, blah, blah. And even so, you know, as much as I knew about the scene then, which wasn't terribly much, but I mean, you know, I knew something. I knew more than my editors at People magazine. But I thought to myself, you know, this guy, Russell Simmons, I should give him a call. And Russell scooped me up And I ended up spending one of the great nights of my life with him. And we went to a variety of clubs downtown in New York, and then we ended up at the end of the night at Disco Fever in the Bronx. And that then was, you know, the epicenter of the rap world and the hip-hop world at the time. It was an after-hours club, and it was just tremendously energetic, just really a wonderful place. And, you know, I decided in the aftermath of that evening that the story for people would be about Disco Fever, that I would let this particular spot stand for the culture at large. And, you know, they went for it. And, you know, the piece was published, as I said, I don't know, March of 83, maybe May of 83. And, you know, not only had this place made an impression on me, but Russell himself had made this tremendous impression. So all of a sudden, it's 1984, Ronald Reagan is running again for president. And I was never a fan of Ronald Reagan. And the thought that he would, you know, run again just made my gorge rise. And, you know, I had this million-dollar idea about how to keep him from taking office. I would write an anti-Reagan rap and give it to Curtis Blow, who I knew didn't write all his own rhymes. And Kurt would record it, and we would rap Ronald Reagan out of the White House. That was my brilliant idea. And and history records just how successful I was.
Rap genius.
So, you know, what happened was, you know, so after I've written this thing, I take it to Russ, and you know, he was very cordial, and he was very polite, and you know, he looked at my lyrics, and I don't think he thought very much of them. And then the two of us got into a more general conversation. And, you know, it concluded with him saying, well, listen, you know, you don't even have a full-time job. Why don't you come work with me? Now, at the time, you know, he was a guy, he was working out of a two-room suite at 1133 Broadway. He had one full-time employee, his executive assistant, Heidi Smith, and he had, you know, some other folks who would do a variety of different things for him. Notably, you know, he needed road managers, certainly at the time, and Russ himself was still going out on the road with the artists. But he had, you know, he had Rush Artist Management or Rush Productions, and he was getting ready to do Def Jam. And other, but you know, these, everything was just so formative.
So many people from that era who came through that door ended up going on to amazing things.
Well, right? I'm just saying, you know, people now, you know, you wonder about Russell Simmons. I mean, or you don't. He's just a star fixed in the firmament, you know. But at the time, you know, he had very, very little going on materially. What he had, though, was this tremendous charisma and this dedication to the culture and business savvy. And I liked him. And working with him seemed at least as interesting to me as, you know, slogging along as a freelance writer for X number more years. I didn't want to do it. So that's how I started working with him.
Yeah, and some of the people in the office in those years, like I said, even not even on the talent side, but people who would,
sure,
who would come in and start as, you know, messengers or road managers or whatever, would end up, you know, the Lee R. Cohen and Ricky Powell and Dante Ross and all these people.
And Bobito Garcia, Lisa Cortez. I'm trying to think all the rest. You know, I mean, really, there were a ton of people who just, you know, have gone on to do remarkable things, and that's just during the early years. You know, then of course, you know, by the early '90s, when Lior moves over from the management side and he's running the label, you know, he pretty self-consciously creates within the company a farm system to develop executive talent, not just creative talent. So, yeah,
that's incredible. So one of the, I think maybe the biggest selling act of that era of sort of the early Def Jam years was the Beastie Boys. And something I always wondered about them during the License to Ill era was it kind of seemed like in a way, and you'd certainly be in a position to know, that whole sort of album and persona was kind of a put on that became real as they became bigger stars.
You know what? It's a little subtler than that, and it's really something that, you know, the Beasties have struggled with to this day. And what it comes down to is this. People underestimate Rick Rubin's influence on the Beastie Boys in terms not only of the records they made, but in terms also of their personae as performers and the entire kind of thrust, so to speak, of what they did. You know, Rick's aesthetic at the time was, you know, he was a fan of Abbott and Costello, the slapstick comedians. He's a fan of professional wrestling, which was, you know, also very cartoonish. And he, the Beastie Boys, I mean, say this, the Beastie Boys came to him with this name, the Beastie Boys, which, you know, is kind of perfect for what Rick envisioned for them. And they also came to him, you know, I mean, they had their bad boy inclinations. They had their humorous inclinations. But Rick is somebody who amped up all of that. And it turned out to be very, very potent, very attractive. You know, they made a great album together. And then they went on out, and they had a year. 1987 for the Beastie Boys was like a year out of the Beatles' history before they, you know, retired. The Beastie Boys were the biggest thing in pop music during that year. And it damn near broke the band up.
Rap Genius.
It would have been exhausting in any case, but, you know, they come off the road at the very end of the year and they just want to chill. And it turns out that, you know, there'd been a lot of tension. You know, there were these kind of disagreements between the band and between Rick Rubin, between the band and Russell, and the three of them kind of huddled together and made a decision that, you know, they were the unit that they wanted to protect. And so they severed their relationship with Def Jam and with Rick and with Russell at that point. And took a couple years to reinvent themselves and then went off in another direction that defined the entire rest of their career. I mean, if you take a look at the Beastie Boys' career even now, you know, there's License to Ill and then there's everything that came afterwards. Those are the two periods of their career, in my opinion. So, I don't know.
How was that decision received at the office at the time? Was it like doomsday or?
No, you know, the thing is, I mean, we were understaffed and we had a lot of success. And it was, you know, there was never a time when there wasn't more work for all of us to do, whether or not the Beastie Boys were around, you know. So, you know, think of it. You know, we had out of our little office, 1987, 1988, you know, Run DMC are still making great records. LL Cool J's making records. You know, remember, it's not just Def Jam. It's also this artist management concern. So during that period, we had, you know, the last records by Curtis Blow. We had Run DMC. We had LL Cool J. We had Houdini making big records at the time. Early in 1987, this new group, Public Enemy, comes out. 88, they put out Nation of Millions. We had EPMD. We had Eric B. and Rakim, you know, killing them. Big Daddy Kane came to us in 87, 88. It's just one future Hall of Fame talent after another, a huge blockbuster roster of talent. And so, you know, I think maybe of everybody who'd worked with the Beasties and were cut off from the Beasties, I think Rick probably took it pretty hard Although, you know, I can't pretend that I was close to him then. But in retrospect, you know, he describes, you know, that breakup as heartbreaking for him. Russell, at least publicly, would have shrugged it off. Lior probably just shrugged it off. But that was a very, very big deal in the history of the label. You know, God knows, it's kind of easy to speculate. What if the Beastie Boys had stayed with Rick and Russell at Def Jam? What all would have happened? But it didn't happen, you know. And I do think that from the Beastie's perspective, they made absolutely the right choice. And, you know, had a... You know, had the career, what it comes down to is that they were able to exercise that much more creative control over their own destiny, their own creative destiny, and they did so. And I think it was probably, you know, very much, it was very satisfying for them to be able to to exercise that kind of control.
And one of the iconic early Def Jam groups, of course, was Run DMC. What?
Not Def Jam. They recorded for Profile.
Oh, right, their Profile, right. But of Rush Management, rather.
They Super Sean.
I know. I'm falling down the job. But I guess one of the things...
But that's common, by the way. People do
people
tend
do
to...
think they recorded for Def Jam.
Yeah.
What effect do you think it had, Russell and Joe being brothers, on their, you know, on the atmosphere, on their... career, on, you know, how they were able to work together?
Well, you know, I don't know what to say. You know, it had the whole, this is going to sound romantic, but the entire setup was very family-like. There weren't a lot of us. We were in the trenches together. We were doing exciting work. We depended on each other. Having said that, you know, that's metaphor. You know, Russell Simmons and Joseph Run Simmons are blood brothers. And I think probably, you know, that became, I'm guessing that really became a complication. That became, you know, difficult internally for Run DMC later. You know, when, you know, the thing about Run DMC is that they started off and they enjoyed such a stupendous winning streak from the release of their very first single in the spring of 1983 through, you know, the release of Raising Hell in 86 and then 87. You know, they're out on the road headlining yet another national tour, and then they co-headline Run DMC and the Beastie Boys on the Together Forever tour. And it's just nonstop success. And then finally they hit a wall, and at that point, you know, the fact that Run was Russell's brother probably started to be pretty irksome to DMC, because whatever, he and Run were going to have beef after a while, as close as they'd been, as brotherly as they'd been. You know, when shit started to go off the rails, and not immediately, but when stuff started to go off the rails, I think D began to resent Russell.
And you had the interesting experience of working with them on a book while they were in their prime, which
right.
is something that never happens. The trend now, of course, for, you know, musician memoirs is it's sort of a mid or end of career, you know, looking back kind of thing.
Right. Yeah, in 1987, I took off a couple of months. I think I took off 7 weeks, and I wrote this book about Run DMC called Tougher Than Leather.
That's crazy, and you, that was all the time that...
Yeah, we had a lot of work
to
do.
Yeah.
I, you know, whatever. How many, you know, I had work to do. I mean, it was really kind of ridiculous. They probably wouldn't have let me do it, except that it was going to be about Run DMC. You know, I've always thought of myself as a writer, and maybe, you know, at that time I was thinking, you know, am I going to stay in the music business, you know, forever, or, you know, will I go back to writing? You know, in 1988, after the Run DMC book came out, I conceived of another book. I wanted to write a book about John Sinclair and the hippies in Ann Arbor and Detroit. I thought there's a book in that. And I wrote a lengthy proposal. I can show it to you, Sean. And tried to get a contract to write that book. And I think maybe, you know, somebody was going to offer me $25,000 to write the book. And I'm thinking, well, what, you know, am I going to starve in the meanwhile? I can't live on $25,000 for a book that's going to take me 2-3 years to write. So I didn't do that. But, you know, yeah, the point was this, you know, as their, I'm their publicist, but I'm also somebody who I had a pretty good idea of you know, what they were achieving culturally and kind of how important they were. And because I'd worked so closely with them, I certainly thought that, you know, the details of their career to that point could sustain a book. And so, and then, you know, finally, crudely, vulgar, you know, commercially, I thought, well, you know, it's another product. You know, it'll help to promote the band. I mean, the idea was we'd put out that book called Tougher Than Leather, and that it would be released in conjunction with a movie called Tougher Than Leather and an album called Tougher Than Leather. And all of these wonderful products would cross-promote each other, and we'd get rich. And, you know, and none of these things happened in conjunction with each other. They all came out at different times.
Sure.
But, you know, that's sort of what I was thinking of when I took the time off to write the book.
One other Run-DMC thing that I've heard you talk about that I never really have seen acknowledged anywhere was the complicated relationship between Run and LL.
Well, you know, what struck me at the time, there was a movie that came out maybe late 70s, early 80s, and it starred Robert Redford. It was called Downhill Racer. And, you know, it's a pretty glossy Hollywood flick, but there's a scene at the end that is stuck in my mind. So you see Redford at the bottom of a hill, and he's just completed a record-breaking run. And he's taken off his goggles, and he's talking to reporters, and there's a beautiful woman there, and he's, you know, inhaling, you know, the thrill of victory. And even kind of mid-rap, you know, as he's doing this, you know, other people's attention starts to stray for a second, and Redford looks back over his shoulder, and there's another skier coming down the hill at a record pace. And so everything stops, and Redford watches this guy, and luckily for him, this poor motherfucker stumbles and doesn't complete the run. So Redford just shrugs it off and finishes the interview, and he wins that day. But that was the relationship between Run and LL. Run was Redford, and the next guy coming down the hill at a tremendous pace was LL Cool J. And at one and the same time, these two guys had tremendous respect and affection for each other, and they were competitive. But all of these guys are competitive with each other. The entire culture is based on, I'm better than you. They're not stabbing each other. It's no more gangs trying to kill each other over, you know, one block or another of you know, a city street. It's competition through the arts. But it's very serious competition. And certainly in rap, the basic impulse, the basic text is, I'm the greatest and you're a sucker MC. Everybody's motivated to be king of the hill. And, you know, so that, you know, that was true of Run and LL as well.
Yeah. And the thing that differentiated Run DMC from the sort of early, you know, say, you know, pre-Def Jam rappers, you know, from, you know, 73 or whenever it started happening to, you know, the first 10 years of the culture, basically, was their dress, right? That was one thing, how they dressed. It was no longer this kind of, like, coming out of P-Funk sort of style, that they dressed like the people they were around, and that came almost entirely from their DJ, right?
Well, what it really comes out of was this. You know, I think of Run DMC as kind of the first group to be born into the culture, more or less pure products of hip-hop culture in a way that, you know, everybody who preceded them was not. You know, looking back, you know, you think of Kurt, you think of Melly Mel and the Furious Five, you think of Bambaataa, you know, they're only 5 years, 7 years older than the guys in Run DMC, but, you know, they'd grown up in an era of funk and disco and rock and roll, and they were very influenced by all of that stuff, not just in their music, but also in you know, their stage apparel. And Run DMC really took more of their cues sort of from the street and from the club scene and from the parks. You know, there had been a generation of young people of color in New York who developed their own style. And it was a musical style and a fashion sense and a language of their own. And Run DMC, you know, absorbed and reflected all of that.
Rap Genius.
Now, your work at Def Jam was as, you know, director of publicity. It seemed like, at least in the early days, you had better luck placing stories in what was sort of traditionally thought of as the white press, the rock press, than a lot of the black press, right?
Well, you know, Russell kind of bitterly says that in general, rock media, which is to say white media, were more receptive to what we were doing than black media. I think that's an oversimplification, but you can look at, you know, some of the landmarks. So, you know, MTV played our videos before BET did. Dick Clark and American Bandstand booked us before Don Cornelius and Soul Train. That kind of stuff hurt Russell. Russell is a proud black man. And having said that, you know, it does seem like there was a kind of a conservatism that defined a lot of what was going on in black-owned media at that time. And that reflected a kind of a generational shift, I think. You know, black folks in media at that time tended to be a little bit older. You know, the style that had defined them and the kind of consciousness that had defined them was, you know, in business at least, it was more corporate, it was more buttoned up, it was more bourgeois. And, you know, here comes, you know, these young rappers, and, you know, they're the type of kids who, you know, would never make it past the velvet rope at a shishi, you know, midtown club. They didn't dress. They wore sneakers. They were rowdy. And so, you know, these older black folks, including folks in media, were repulsed by hip-hop and by rap at that time. And meanwhile, certainly by the time Run DMC comes along, Run DMC were, their whole style was much more kind of punk rock than what had preceded them. It was very stripped down. It wasn't very much more than beats and rhymes, and they were shouting. And, you know, certainly by 86 when they make, I mean, also by, well, even earlier, by 84 they make a song called Rock Box. By 85 they make a song and a video called King of Rock. By 86 they come out with, you know, a remake of Aerosmith's Walk This Way. So these were all, you know, if you know, you needed actually to hang a sign on what they were doing that said, we make rock and roll too. It's not, you know, whatever you think rap is, well, guess what? You know, the membrane that separates rock and rap is so goddamn thin. Don't worry about it. We're not white, but we make rock and roll too. And that's a message that a lot of folks in rock media and white media were able to hear. It wasn't a problem. So, you know, we got support from Rolling Stone right away. We got support from the Village Voice very, very early on. The Village Voice, you know, was crucial. We got some love from the New York Times. We got a lot of love from Billboard right away. But, you know, having said all that, it's not to say, you know, that Right On magazine, and Black Beat magazine, which were the black teen monthlies. You know, they gave us some love. And there were individual black journalists who gave, you know, younger folks who tended to give us some love. But having said all of that, I will say that I always felt my job was very, very much easier than Bill Stefanie's job. You know, Bill Stefanie
did radio.
Bill Stefanie had to promote to radio, and that was really like banging your head against a wall, because it's not just that black radio wouldn't play this rap stuff, but rock radio wouldn't play it either. That was a mess. But, you know, for me, trying to get, you know, some love for my guys in print media and then also on television, much, much easier.
One of the things that really, you know, differentiated Def Jam from other labels and at the time was a very keen visual sense. So I know you guys had an on-staff artist who coordinated a lot of that stuff, right?
Well, you can say that the fact that we paid so much attention to the visual aspect of everything was built into the DNA of the label's founders, both of them. You know, Rick is somebody who had a vision for the logo, and it turned out to be, you know, a beautiful design, and a really iconic design. And Russell is somebody who always paid a lot of attention to, you know, what people wore and would eventually found his own fashion brand, more than one. So those two guys were always going to pay a lot of attention. Rick certainly was somebody who cared an awful lot about album cover art also. And, you know, by the time I started working there, right around the time I started working with Russ, you know, he also... he had Say Adams aboard, and Say was, you know, I think, you know, ultimately they gave him the title of creative director, but he was just a guy at the time who did everything that needed to be done visually. Is the band going out on the road? Does it, you know, do any number of these bands need 30-foot backdrops to furl and unfurl when they perform? Well, Say, who came out of the graffiti world, would create these backdrops. He'd create logos. He created... hats and t-shirts and that kind of stuff. And then, you know, he shifted over, you know, soon enough, and he's designing album covers and he's designing advertising and you know, whatever all needed to be done. So yeah, the label the label paid attention to the visual side of things too.
And that interest for you continued into your future work. You ran a ton of stuff with hip hop photography. Ran a gallery for a while.
Yeah, I'm not saying, you know, it's so funny. You know, I'm not saying that I don't have taste when it comes to the visual side of things. I think I do, but that stuff really kind of grew more out of my sense of history than my sense of fashion. Mm. You know, I'm somebody who wanted to document what all we were doing, because, you know, like all of pop culture, this stuff, you know, blows away in the wind for the most part, you know, especially in America. You know, there's not much of a sense of history. It's always, you know, what's new and what's next, and nothing is built to last. And really, by the time that I go to work with Russell, I already had a sense of history, and I'd already begun building my own private archive, musical archive of devoted to the artists who moved me and who I thought were important and who'd had, you know, an impact on my life. And as far as I'm concerned, they'd also already, you know, made their impact on American culture and American history. So, you know, I founded an art gallery devoted to hip-hop photography in 2003, but, you know, it says at least as much about my sense of history as it does for my love of a very good photograph.
Mm-hmm. And I wanted to talk about that archiving impulse a little bit. Having seen your extensive archives, and Lisa, you know, a little bit of it, it just really struck me that it's an incredibly unique collection of all kinds of things. And I was wondering if you could, you know, talk about your impulse to create that and a little bit about what it is.
You know, I started to build my own personal little research library when I was in my early 20s, and I was just starting to write about music, and I felt that there wasn't enough reliable research material available to help me as a writer, you know, if and when, you know, I'm writing, and particularly, you know, given, you know, my deep affection for artists of color in particular, for black artists in America in particular, and you know, it's not like there were a ton of wonderful encyclopedias available then, and there's no internet, and it's kind of hard to figure this stuff out. And so to the extent, you know, if an artist is coming to Ann Arbor and I have to write about, you know, if it's Bobby Blue Bland, the great R&B singer, and I recommend all your viewers and listeners and whatnot, you know, should look up his music. You know, there's a song that Jay-Z, among many others, has sampled from a Bobby Blue Bland record early in the 70s. It's called Ain't No Love in the Heart of the City. Well, you know, all due respect to Jay-Z, but check out Bobby Bland's original from 74, maybe. So Bobby Bland is coming to town, and, you know, I don't have enough information about him. I get the new album, I've got a photo, there's a bio that the record label puts out, and it occurred to me that maybe it'd be smart for me to hang on to these things so that I could refer to them as time went by. So that's my original impulse. By the time I start working with Russell 10 years later, 1984, you know, I'd put together, you know, a fairly extensive archive on you know, the artists that I felt, you know, the artists that I loved. You know, I would just, I would start files, I don't want to say promiscuously, there's plenty of stuff. I mean, you know, did I need to start a file on Michael Jackson? You know, some of the stuff, I mean, some of the artists I loved were just so gigantic, I didn't feel like I had to, you know, follow them obsessively. But, you know, most of the jazz guys I loved, you know, somebody like Ornette Coleman, you know, people wrote about Ornette, but, you know, in the larger scheme of things, in American pop culture, you know, he's an avant-gardist, he's obscure. If and when somebody smart wrote something at length about Ornette, I'm going to clip it and hold on to it, because I'm going to learn something and I'll be able to refer to it down the line. It'll help me, at the very least, understand better what I want to understand. And so I had, you know, a decent little archive by 84, and I started collecting materials on these rappers as well, because, you know, I'd been paying attention for 5 years at that point. You know, I had a better, I had better files on Curtis Blow, better press files on Curtis Blow than Russell did, you know. So, and then, you know, once I started working for Russ, then I'm in the process really of generating a lot of the materials that I would want to collect. You know, I write the bios, I write the press releases, I hire the photographers. And so, as a matter of course, I would hold on to at least one copy of everything. And you know, so those files would grow. And, you know, I continued to do it after I stopped working with Russell, just as I'd done it before I started working with him. So now, you know, it's all these years later, and the collection, you know, there's a lot of stuff in it. You know, it includes, you know, records, although I'm not an obsessive record collector. I mean, there are people who collect rap records who, you know, they've got collections of, you know, 100,000, you know, records. That's not me. But I've held on to a lot of records that I love, and I prize them not just for the music, but I prize them for the album covers, for the art. Because, you know, sometimes, I mean, you know, it's an art form unto itself, let me just say that, but also there's historical value to it. You know, I've been talking to these people at TV One recently. They've got a series called Celebrity Crime Files or something, and they're doing a story about Scott LaRock. Well, you know, there's not a lot of extant imagery on Scott LaRock. You know, I've got some stuff, but I also happen to have, you know, a couple of records, early Boogie Down Production records, with his photo on it. Okay, boom, this is a nice, clear 12-inch by 12-inch photo of a man who was shot to death at the age of 25 in 1987. It's important, I believe, to hold on to that kind of stuff. And, you know, as I was just suggesting as well, you know, the what I discovered pretty early on, certainly, you know, not long after I started working with Russell, was that, you know, these files, which I'd conceived of to help me, were useful to other writers and editors, and to, you know, down the line to documentary film makers and to news producers and on and on. And that's continued to be true. And so now it's all these years later, it's a generation later, and here comes Rap Genius. And, you know, Super Sean comes to my house one day, and I knew I had something for him because I'd taken enough of a look at the site to, you know, understand that, you know, you guys were devoted to lyrics. And I thought, well, let me show this man something that probably he hasn't seen before, namely, you know, Chuck D's handwritten lyrics for every song on the Nation of Millions album.
Which, for the record, did almost literally blow my head off.
Right.
Looking at that stuff.
Right. And you know, and it's so gratifying to me, you know, just because, you know, I was right and I thought you'd be moved by it. You know, doesn't diminish the pleasure that I take in having held on to it and being able to share it with you, because it confirms my sense that, you know, that this stuff is important.
Yeah, and you've taken stuff from that archives and used it in, you know, your coffee table book about Def Jam and the TV series. Well.
Right, we did, you know, And You Don't Stop, 30 Years of Hip Hop, which was a five-part history of hip hop, documentary history of hip hop that we did for VH1. Yeah. You know, I understand more clearly than ever that if you want to tell these stories, you know, it's important to have held on to these artifacts, these photos, these recordings, you know, magazine stories, the front page of a newspaper, the flyers that people generate. And, you know, that's, you know, most of this, the kinds of things that I've held on to. But again, you know, in intellectual terms, in culture worker terms, this stuff is called ephemera for the most part. That's because it's ephemeral. It fucking blows away in the wind. Nobody holds on to it, you know. But, you know, take a look at, you know, Cornell University right now. You know, they've got a growing hip-hop archive, and one of the gems of their archive now is a collection of flyers that were created by Buddy Esquire, who was an early, important maker of party flyers. That's what he did. And, you know, he made them, you know, week by week, and they went up, you know, on telephone poles throughout the Bronx, and maybe you'd stick them onto a subway. And then the shit was flushed. They disappeared. Very, very few people were able to step back and say, you know what, these flyers meant to fly away have creative value and cultural value and historical value, and some damn body ought to hold on to them. But, you know, Buddy himself held on to them. There were a couple other people, and, you know, all these years later, Cornell was able to amass a collection of this stuff. It's very much to their credit.
Yeah, and that's amazing, and stuff like that. Right, not only does it have artistic value in terms of the people drawing them, and I don't think a lot of them even necessarily saw it that way. They just thought it was something they did super quickly.
Well, I think most of the people who made posters, a lot of the, you know, the people who did it repeatedly, somebody like Buddy, he saw himself as an artist.
Yeah, and then, but also it's a document of the scene, right? Of the acts that were playing together. And oh my
right,
God,
it occurred, and it's
on the bill together and, you know, whatever.
It's that old news reporter thing. It's the five W's. You know, a news story is who, what, when, where, why. Okay? There it is. All that information is on every single flyer. These performers in this place for this purpose on this date. You can't beat it. You know, talk about, you know, metadata. This shit's just so rich.
Yeah. It's incredible. And very, you know, winding down a little bit, I would be remiss if I didn't talk to you about just briefly kind of what it was like to be around, who, for my money, the greatest group and the greatest album of all time, Public Enemy, around sort of the Nation of Millions era.
Look, you know, I'm going to try and figure out something, you know, brief to say about it, but suffice it to say, to start, that I believe there's a book in that moment, really. You know, I'd like to put together a detailed oral history of the history of Public Enemy, the story of Public Enemy, from, oh, really, it starts before they come together on the campus of Adelphi University in the early 80s, but, you know, certainly really starting at that point and through the release of their first record, and then Nation of Millions, and then the success of Nation of Millions and the hailing of Nation of Millions, and kind of unforeseeably, you know, the terrible breakup of the group. I think, you know, I mean, and I'm here to tell you, 1988, 1989, into 1990, those were those were tumultuous years in the career of Public Enemy and all of us who worked with Public Enemy at the time. So, I mean, I don't know what to say. It was very exciting. You know, it was also, you know, very frustrating. You know, they raised up everybody's hopes so high. You know, they really, they brought a 60s sensibility, to my way of thinking. They brought a 60s sensibility, a kind of a Black Panther sensibility into hip-hop. And there are lots of folks who were looking for that kind of thing, even if they couldn't name it. And here comes Public Enemy, the Black Panthers of rap. And not only were they politically admirable for the most part, but the music they made would really take your head off.
Rap Genius.
Which is really, as a 60s guy, I'm here to tell you, if the music doesn't match the politics, I kind of don't give a fuck. You can be righteous all day long. You can be politically correct all day long. And if, you know, the art, whatever it is, let's say it's music, if the music isn't on a par with, you know, your revolutionary consciousness, personally, I don't give a fuck. You know, put it on a poster and, you know, write it off. You're done. You know, but Public Enemy, God dog, you know, the music is so powerful and the message is so powerful. And you know, the music and the message, you know, melded so magnificently, and that's why we honor that album and that group and that moment, you know, to the extent that we do these days. It was just magnificent. You know, unfortunately, you know, there were a number of kind of internal contradictions, as the Marxists might say,
yeah.
That led to the breakup of the group. And you know, I want to point out to your younger folks, it's not to say that Public Enemy didn't go on. They did. They have. You know, they continue to more or less to tour nonstop. But it's a different group. You know, Chuck, who I love, dear friend, you know, probably wouldn't be happy to hear me say this. You know, I don't know if he'll hear me say this, but, you know, I believe that, you know, they were, you know, the group of folks who put together Nation of Millions was, you know, the ideal World Series lineup of Public Enemy. And although, you know, so that lineup kind of crashed and burned, and Chuck has been able to emerge from the ashes with a very, very creditable version of Public Enemy, you know, one that's lasted, you know, going on 25 years now, almost, since all of that occurred. So, yes, Public Enemy is still a force in 2013, but, you know, my interest in them as a writer, looking back, kind of peaks in 88, 89, 90.
Yeah, with those albums. I mean, a lot of things conspired to end that kind of like 87 to 91 classic period, for lack of a better term. I mean, you know, the internal contradictions you were talking about, but even things like sampling laws and so the codifying of sampling laws.
Right.
You know.
Yeah, you know, I, you know, you might have thought about it more deeply than I have. I mean, you know, all I know is that, you know, here's PE, and they inaugurate an era of conscious rap and inspire a lot of folks, including a ton of artists, and growing up kind of alongside it were, you know, the New York groups called who gathered together under the banner of the Native Tongues Posse. So that's De La Soul and the Jungle Brothers and some of those folks. And probably Queen Latifah. And they were...
All discovered by a former Def Jam messenger.
I don't know about all that. You know, have you spoken to Dante? Oh, you did Dante. Okay.
Yeah.
I have no comment about that. Dante's a great man. But I'm just saying, yeah, so there's all of that. And you know, that you can say that represents a kind of a high point in the political and cultural consciousness of hip-hop. You know, certainly you're going to say it if you're a New Yorker like me. And even so, largely, that stuff was swept aside by gangster rap. Not to say that there haven't been, you know, any number of artists who have followed in the footsteps of Public Enemy and followed in the footsteps of the Native Tongues and tried to do kind of more humanistic things. But gangster rap, you know, and even to speak of it generically is, it's not so useful. Sure it is. I'm just saying, so-called gangster rap appears to be the reigning, or say the default mode for hip-hop and for rap ever since. And I'm not sure why it is. I mean, except, you know, what occurs to me is that Public Enemy really was, you know, bucking the tide. Even when they came in, I mean, they decried, you know, the materialism and the kind of empty-mindedness of rap that preceded them. They were huge fans of it, and even so, they thought, you know, the music needs to be smarter than this. You know, the times require hip-hop that is more engaged politically than what we're hearing. And so, you know, if nobody else is going to make that hip-hop, we'll make it. That's the inspiration for the creation of Public Enemy right there. We're going to make the music that we want to hear and that we don't hear right now.
Interestingly, Chuck, like you, was a few years older than the people he was around pretty much all the time.
Sure. You know, he went to Black Panther, you know, summer camp, you know. So I'm just saying, but he was bucking a trend. The idea always was we're going to inject political consciousness into the mainstream of hip-hop. And they did it. And they were successful. And it's remarkable. And it continues to inspire us to this day. But, you know, I think, you know, the culture has kind of receded since then. The level of consciousness in the music, or the ambitiousness, the political ambitiousness of the music, has receded since then. And now you don't get hip-hop that's any better than the culture at large. I mean, as a 60s guy myself, you know, what I saw was that the black community and some of and people like Martin Luther King in particular, set the moral tone for America and set the moral agenda for America. You couldn't depend on, you know, government to really deal with the civil rights crisis in this country. It was done from outside government. You know, likewise, you know, we were in this miserable Vietnam War. You couldn't expect government to wind it down or to end it. That was, you know, forced on them by an anti-war movement. But with regard to black folks, you know, it was a tremendous period. There were these black leaders and there was this, you know, tremendous community response, and it lit up everybody. And then that, those folks were eliminated. They were killed off. And I think the black community, and this is a terrible generalization, but I think that the black community has been relatively rudderless since then. You haven't seen, you know, folks like MLK, you know, emerge as a global beacon of humanity in quite the same way. Black folks were in the vanguard of American culture and American morality in the 60s and the early 70s, okay? And with the elimination of, you know, black leadership, you know, American culture, you know, has just become so terribly materialistic. And the hip-hop that we hear today is no better than the culture at large. There was a time when you might have expected black music to be more engaging than white music because black folks were more engaging. That's what I feel. And now, you know, what does Martin Luther King mean to the average rapper compared to Donald Trump? You know, Donald Trump is a god to your average rapper. And you know, he's a fucking clown to me. He's just a silly, he's an embarrassment, and he's a clown. And, you know, the notion of, the notion that somebody is going to become an American hero because of his vulgar and relentless pursuit of wealth as a goal in itself, geez, it's embarrassing. But, you know, most rappers take that very, very seriously. There's nothing going on but the accumulation of personal wealth and self-aggrandizement. And it's tremendously disheartening. And the only way that I let these rappers off the hook and I let the culture off the hook is to say, well, it's not like the culture at large is any better. It's not. You know, America, you know, I'm really going to get going here, but I just say, you know, America is in terrible, terrible decline right now. You know, we'll go back to the beginning here. We can tie this off right now. Ready? Because we started talking about the 60s. I'm a 60s guy. And the thing about being a hippie during that period is that it was tremendously hopeful. We had a vision of the future that was going to be more humane, more equitable for everybody. It was going to be Eden. And now, a generation later, you look back, and, you know, there have been social gains and whatnot, but basically, this country is a terrible, terrible disappointment in so many ways because it seems like there's nothing going on but the pursuit of money now, in a way that was not true a generation ago.
Well, I think that's as somewhat dispiriting, but perhaps realistic.
Well, it's not to say, you know, guess what? I feel dispirited sometimes. Yeah. And yet, you know, here's what's good. I'm a music lover, and there's plenty of music that's been recorded that I continue to listen to that makes me feel good. I'm a married man, and my wife gives me, you know, my wife and our marriage is central to me and makes me feel good. I've got two children. I love them. and they're coming along in the world. I live in New York City, which is an oasis in a lot of ways. And so these are the, you know, when I want to count my blessings against, you know, an image of the decline of the West, that's what I do.
That's beautiful. Thank you so much for coming out and spending time with us. We really appreciate it.
Fun for me. You know, I'm a fan of Rap Genius, so there's another reason to be hopeful.
Well, thank you very much.
Yeah, man.
That was our conversation with Bill Adler. Join us in 2 weeks when we talk to legendary DJ Cypher Sounds about his long and incredibly varied career. Outside the Lines with Rap Genius is created and written by Sean Sotero, a.k.a. Same Old Sean.
He's just a star fixed in the firmament, you know.
The show is produced and engineered by Josh Cross at Crosstown Studios.
Didn't even pretend to give a fuck about it.
Our music is by Psionic.
Am I going to stay in the music business, you know, forever? Or, you know, will I go back to writing?
The creator of the upcoming OutsideTheLinesPodcast.com is Paul Dice.
Non-stop success. And then finally, they hit a wall.
Special thanks again to Bill Adler for access to the Adler Archives in preparation for this interview and tons of stuff on Rap Genius. You can follow us on Twitter at OTL_podcast. And on Facebook at Outside the Lines with Rap Genius. If you like what you heard on Outside the Lines, visit us on iTunes. From there, you can listen to past shows and leave us a review. The more positive reviews we get, the better chance we have of continuing to get amazing guests like Bill Adler. We'll see you in 2 weeks, Outside the Lines. We know everything is working. Yeah, everything should be good to go. Awesome.